This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good evening. It is Wednesday, May 22nd. And the topic for today's class in current Jewish questions is music in Judaism. And we're going to discuss a couple of questions that, recur in, various forms, including we'll discuss on Kol Isha, women singing towards the end, even though we could probably do a full class on that. We'll try to at least give a very basic overview of the issues, because I know that's relevant to a lot of, both men and women in terms of what that's about. Also, can reference the Tziniyut class that we did on modesty. I think that was like class, current Jewish questions 2, I think, way back when. I wanted to speak more about music in Judaism and start with you sort of a, positive sense about where music is. Someone, not just someone, a few people in synagogue have, told me that music should be integrated and become a more important part and component of our ritual service. We happen to do a fair amount of singing here. We do a Karl Bach Friday night, though it's not as schleppy as other places. Some people have absolutely no patience for any sort of singing. I personally can't stand chazanut. I was like that all my life. Karl Bach davening for some is really inspirational. You can get into it. One of my issues with chazanut is I've experienced too many chazanim who sing in such a way that preclude any involvement. Like, there's a difference between davening feeling long and being long. So when a chazan davening, you're just sit there forced to listen to him, it feels long. We don't have the same aesthetic, and we'll actually talk about chazanut a little bit later. It doesn't have that same sort of aesthetic, we don't have the same aesthetic appreciation as they might have had, a couple of decades ago, or even a century ago. Whereas today, like Karl Bach, he can get into it. It's a lot more active, so it doesn't feel as long. For others, it actually does feel long. Like, you go to Ashkam, you daven quick, no fuss, no muss, you go home. That's what people want. But let's start off, at the very beginning about some sources about, they call this section, the spiritual importance of music and the importance of spiritual music. And it's a subtle distinction, but one that's worth making. Let's start us off. All right, this is a Gemara Pesachim 117a. With a brief elision in the middle.
Me?
Yeah.
Rav Judah said in Shmuel's name, the song of the Torah was uttered by Moses and Israel when they ascended from the Red Sea. And who recited this Hallel? The prophets among them ordained that Israel should recite it in every important epoch and every misfortune.
Epoch, sorry.
And every misfortune. May it not come upon them, and when they redeemed, they recite in gratitude for their redemption.
Epic. Right. So here, this is the source for like Hallel, to be said at not just in the occasions that we have, but really at any time. The language in the Gemara here is Al Kol Tzarah V'Tzarah Shelo Tavo Alehen, for any bad thing which didn't come upon them, K'shenigalin Omri Motan Agulatan. When you're redeemed, then you say Hallel over it. So if something bad happened and you got out of it, well, that's when you say Hallel. This Gemara, by the way, is the basis for people saying Hallel with a bracha on things like Yom Ha'atzma'ut or Yom Yerushalayim. Because if you view it as a tzara, right, it says Nevi'im Shebeneihem, that the prophets among them. So the question is, I shouldn't say that. The question, there are many questions that come up, but one approach from this Gemara is that since we have a takana, we have a decree at some point in our history, that at any period of, when bad stuff was going on, of oppression, and we got out of it, we say Hallel, which is a special type of, praise. Now, we'll get to the song part in a second, but this is where, the debate comes in, whether or not Yom Yerushalayim or Yom Ha'atzma'ut fall under this category. Continue. This is skipping a bit in the Gemara.
To David, a psalm intimates that Shekhinah rested on them and then he uttered the song. The Psalm of David indicates that he uttered that psalm and then the Shekhinah rested on them, upon him.
All right, so this is where the Gemara discusses in Tehillim, Book of Psalms. You have sometimes it written Le David Mizmor as the introduction. Sometimes it's Mizmor Le David. The Gemara says when it's Le David Mizmor in that order, it implies that The Shekhinah came first, meaning he was divinely inspired, and then he wrote the song. When it says Mizmor le David, then the Mizmor came first, and then after writing the Mizmor, then he got the Shekhinah.
This teaches you that Shekhinah rests neither in indolence, nor in gloom, nor in frivolity, nor in levity, nor in vain pursuits, but only in rejoicing connected with religious acts. For it is said, but now bring me a minstrel. And it came to pass when the minstrel played that the hand of the Lord came upon him.
Right, so I underline this because Yav Halacha, that in order to feel the Shekhinah, you have to be in a certain emotional state. And one of the ways that you get in the emotional state is music. Right? And you have the pasuk here is like, well, I need to be inspired. So, like, you know what? And, you know, according from the pasuk in Malachim Bet 3:15, Kings 2:3:15, it says, you know, Ataka huli minagen. Get me someone to play me some music, and then the Spirit of the Lord is going to come upon me. There's actually a school that I know of in Israel, run by the daughter of one of my rebbeim, where she teaches the kids Chalil, the recorder. Mm. And the reason is, I mean, Chalil's a pretty common instrument, but no, she actually has a purpose in teaching the kids Chalil. What is the purpose? When Mashiach is going to come, when the Messiah is going to arrive, they're going to be prophets. Who's going to play music for those prophets in order to prophesy? They're going to come from our school, because mm-hmm. we're going to teach them Chalil. Now, keep in mind, you know, I don't know how many people feel, you know, good or better or ready to receive divine inspiration hearing five-year-olds play the Chalil, but the heart's in the right place.
What's the Chalil?
The Chalil is the recorder. You never play the Chalil?
Recorder, I think of tape recorder.
I don't even know how to describe it. We used to, look, you could get like the really super cheap plastic. Do you know what a...
Yes.
Thank you.
Right? It's like a flute, but it's plastic.
Oh, flute.
When you compare a recorder to a flute, you are like picking a fight in certain musical mm-hmm. worlds, right? There, you don't do that, mm-hmm. right? And just see, that's why you hit pause on the recorder here, uh-huh. and why you're lucky. Like you just said, was heresy uh-huh. for a lot of people there, right? Recorder's not a flute, but trust me, it's one of those things where a lot. When I was in first grade, they uh-huh. gave us a chalil. Why? Because you can get them out of cheap plastic. Mm-hmm. Right? You can teach kids music. You're like, oh, you can play an instrument, and you're effectively giving them a toy. Uh-huh. Right? But the point is, right, going back
it's to... It's like a flute, but much better, allegedly.
In fairness, that's not entirely true. When it comes to instruments, it depends who plays it.
Ah.
For example, a violin can be beautiful, mm-hmm. but if you hit a wrong note in a violin, it screeches, and that's really painful. Mm-hmm. Pianos, you don't have the same problem with getting a wrong note. Like, mm-hmm. you can hit a wrong note, and then your melody sounds bad or sounds off. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's not... You don't have the same effect of a screech. In the guitar, sometimes if you don't hit it right, you may get a buzz, mm-hmm. right, which sounds off, which isn't as bad as a screech. So... I don't think it's a flaw in the instrument sometimes as much as who plays it and how it's being played. Mm-hmm. So, but the point is, from this Gemara at least, is that music is sometimes essential and a prerequisite for divine inspiration. Not because it's music per se, but music allows you to regulate your emotional state to put you in the appropriate state, let's say of equanimity, in order to be able to receive prophecy and really encounter God. That's what music has the potential to do. And the Gemara goes on here and has a whole bunch of other stuff here about, you know, what is the proper place about being, you know, standing with anxiety. Ends off with Rabba that began by saying something humorous to begin a lecture to get people in the right state, the miltibidi dibidi chuta. Right? So you start by saying a joke, like, you know, many... when the older books of speech making always said, oh, you begin with a funny story. Why? Because you get people in the right mood. Music can get you in the right mood for spiritual worship. Right? We're not talking about music as part of spiritual worship here. It's even just getting you into the proper state of it. Right? Take the next one. Similarly, but from a different perspective. This is a Gemara in Shabbat 30b.
Where are we?
Source 2 on page 1.
Yeah. Or down here? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, if you don't want to... Oh, I should have said this too. You know, if you don't want to, you just say pass.
Oh, no, it's fine. And how are its words self-contradictory?
Referring to Kohelet, Ecclesiastes. The Gemara said that they wanted to Bikshu Chachamim Lignoz. They wanted to hide it away or censor it, right? Because things contradicts itself. So it says, well, how does it contradict itself? Okay. Continue.
It is written, anger is better than play, but it is written, I said of laughter, it is to be praised. It is written, then I commended joy. But it is written, and of joy, what doeth it? There is no difficulty. Anger is better than laughter. The anger which the Holy One, blessed be He, displays to the righteous in this world is better than the laughter which the Holy One, blessed be He, laughs with the wicked in this world. And I said of laughter, it is to be praised. That refers to the laughter which the Holy One, blessed be He, laughs with the righteous in the world to come. Then I commended joy. This refers to the joy of a precept. And of joy, what doeth it? This refers to joy not in connection with a precept. This teaches you that the divine presence rests neither through gloom, nor through sloth, nor through frivolity, nor through levity, nor through talk, nor through idle chatter, save through a matter of joy in connection with the precept, as it is said. But now bring me a minstrel. And it came to pass, when the minstrel played, that the hand of the Lord came upon him.
All right, now here, it's the same, punchline, but it's coming at it from a slightly different approach from Kohelet. Whereas from Kohelet, you really get a better sense of balance, right? And again, you know, music has that ability, and you're normally it's like, oh, you should only be happy, and so listen to music. Music can also be a downer. One thing I actually didn't include here is that there's a Gemara in Brachot where people, Chachamim, were too happy at a wedding. And this is actually the source where you have about breaking a glass at a wedding. So one example is like, oh, we were too happy. How do we like calm ourselves down? Someone broke a glass. According to the Gemara, or based on the Gemara, the first time you have a Gemara a glass broken at a wedding had nothing to do with the Korban. It had to do with being too happy because the proper emotional state of a Talmid Chacham is supposed to be, you know, have equanimity. One of the other suggestions, well, not suggestions, they write it as a Ma'aseh Shaya, something that happened, was that they were too happy. So how did they get calmed down? Someone started singing, woe to us, we're all going to die, woe to us, we're all going to die. Which is, you know, part of the reason why in the event I ever get married, I want them to play Don't Fear the Reaper, because it would just be funny. And partially for that, Gemara, but it's also a cool song. Point is this, you know, there are times when music can be a downer. Music can also lift you up. The point is that music has a spiritual component, and it means that music can be used as a spiritual component, right? And I didn't even begin to cite any of the sources about Shira, the song being an integral part of the temple service. A whole bunch of Gemaras that talk about the Shira. But it was, right? You know, used to bring the Korban a la Shira, right? We obviously don't have recordings of that, but there is, you know, there is, I think, clearly from the Gemara, and understand that music can have a very spiritual component to it, mm-hmm. and can play an important role in our spiritual lives, if not an essential one, if that's how you are so attuned, no pun intended for that one. Where the questions really come up, though, right, is what the, like, when people criticize music, right, it would usually be under either the non-sacred or profane type of music. Start off here with a Mishnah in Sota 9:1. It says, when the Sanhedrin ceased to function, song ceased from the places of feasting. As it is said, they shall not drink wine with the song. Okay? That's the verse from Isaiah 24:9. The Gemara elaborates, how do we know from the text that, they shall not drink wine with a song? Applies to the time when the Sanhedrin ceased, meaning, what correlation is there between the Sanhedrin, the great court of Jewish law and Jewish life, for that matter? What is the connection, between them ceasing to function and singing songs in a Beit Mishtah, in a place of feasting, or technically it's really a place of drink? Place of feasting, let's use with the Sincino there. Said Rav Huna, son of Rav Joshua, said, because Scripture states the elders have ceased from the gate, the young men from their music. This is a pasuk in Eicha, Lamentations 5:14. So from here, the Talmud is making a logical correlation based on this verse between elders sitting in the gate, which is where the court, well, sat, and the young men from their music. So therefore, when one goes, so does the other. Rav said, well, actually, before we get to the next paragraph that I have here in this section of the Gemara, any thoughts on this? Over, go on. All right, so conceptually, does anyone here have any other like conceptual connections between the dissolution of the Sanhedrin and not listening to music? Or specifically, not listening to music in a Beit Mishteh? Right? Literally, it's an interesting distinction that one could make, or at least before we go further. According to the Mishnah, it's when the Sanhedrin stopped functioning, right? But la shir, right? Then the shir mi beit mishtaot. And really, these weren't just like place of feasting. These were like pubs, right? So the verse from Isaiah that's quoted is Bashir lo yishtu yayin, of not specifically not singing over wine. According to the verse that's quoted in Eicha, it would seem to apply to all singing, to every type of singing, right? Because it's Zekenim Mishar Shavtu Bachorim Miniginatam, young men from their songs, but the whole Beit Mishteh, or singing over wine, is not qualified. Strictly speaking from the Mishnah, the problem is, music in a bar. According to the Pasuk in Eicha, it would probably be more expansive than that. The Gemara continues. Rav said, the ear which listens to song should be torn off. And this is unqualified. This would seem to be more of a direct extension from that verse in Eicha. Rava said, when there is song in a house, there is destruction on its threshold. As it is stated, their voice shall sing in the windows. Desolation shall be in their thresholds, for he hath laid bare their cedar work. Now this is pretty extreme right here. This, according to Rava, all music is prohibited. Continuing, you're skipping a few lines in the Gemara. Rav Huda said, the singing of sailors and plowmen is permitted, but that of weavers is prohibited. The Cincino footnote says, singing helps the former in their work. Right? Sea chanties, anyone? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? That's actually going to come up later in the class. You know, what shall we do with a drunken sailor?
NFL films.
Yes! Yes! And someplace else that you might not be aware of. And the latter is done with frivolity. Rav Huna abolished singing. Here's a remarkable story. So Rav Huna...
Just as you hear the singing side.
All right, because we got the Russian Arts Theater Society up there singing. And 100 geese were priced at Azuz, and 100 seahs of wheat at Azuz, and there was no demand for them even at their price through the decline of feasting. Meaning Rav Huna, it just says here, Batil's Zimra. He stopped singing. Anyone here remember the movie Footloose?
Yes.
Right. So they tried banning dancing. Rav Huna banned singing. So what happened? Food, party food, no one wanted anymore. Right, so the geese, which were originally a party food, and the wheat from parties, they crashed because no one's having parties anyway. See, party crashing. See, there you go. Rav Chisda came in and ordered Rav Huna's edict to be disregarded, and a goose was required even at the high price of Azuz, but was not to be found. I mean, the demand for geese had become so great, so Rav Huna was really strict, and he said, "Nope, no singing." Things crashed. Prices crashed. Then Rav Chisda came in and said, you got to overturn that. And he did. So in retrospect, this probably could also fit into our shir on chumras, and being like overly strict and a whole bunch of other things. It's a really, it's a shame, we can't really spend so much time like delving into the nuances of all these Gemaras, right? But at least for our purposes, someone tried to ban singing. The ramifications, even though they were expressed here in pure economic terms, if you think about it, let's say, is singing really that bad, right? If the reason why you have to, if it's so bad, the reason why, according to this, again, we don't know what's going on in people's heads, but based on the details in the Gemara, the reason why it had to be overturned wasn't because people need music. It's part of our soul. It's because you're killing the party industry, right? Geese aren't, you know, it's like you're killing the geese market. It's a weird, you know, again, is that what happened? I don't know, but that seems to be the implication just from the data the Gemara is giving us. Anyway, Rav Yosef said, oh, I should also say that Rav Huna, remember, initially said, some type of singing is okay, sometimes it's not. And the intention, perhaps, is what matters. All right? Rav Joseph said, when men sing and women join in, it is licentiousness. When women sing and men join in, it is like fire in tow. As Sensino explains, a woman singing arouses sexual passion. The latter is more serious because it implies a willful act on the part of the men to listen to the female voices. For what practical purpose is this mentioned? Meaning, if men and women can't sing together, why do you say men singing with women and women singing, like, what's the difference? To abolish the latter before the former. Meaning, if both cannot be suppressed at the same time, the latter should receive more attention as being the worst of the two. Meaning, it's worse if a woman sings and a man joins in than if a man sings and a woman joins in. Because since a woman singing here is considered to be licentious, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, if a man sings with a woman, he is making a conscious decision to be a part of that. And since that's considered worse, if you have the option to stop or to do what we call mima'it bi'isur, minimize the transgression, the best way to minimize the transgression is, like, if, again, assuming you can't stop, you're trying to minimize it, better the men sing first and women join in than women lead and men join in, according to this opinion. And finally, Rav Yochanan said, whoever drinks to the accompaniment of the four musical instruments brings five punishments to the world. And he elaborates on that. So stop here for a second. So right now, right, you have some statements about music being absolutely prohibited, right? Particularly that we saw of Rav and Rava. But you have other statements that seem to have it qualified, in that they're not that music is intrinsically wrong, but certain types of music, or music in certain contexts. For example, pub music might be different than, say, singing in shul. And, well, it depends on what type of minion you're in and whether or not you have... you got to understand my, you know, drift here, right? Music we had before, bring me a minagain. I mean, I don't want to get into a... You know, I could, but I don't want to because I don't know how to get into a real difference between what's a minagain and a zemer. And, like, how you would even begin to differentiate between those two. But it seemed that being
a what and a what?
Minagain and a mizamer. Like a nigun and a zmira, or zemer. Right. I'm sure if anyone's listening to this, you know, and you've got any thoughts, please let me know, and let me know how you get to that distinction. Like, maybe one specifically the words and the others, you know, doesn't have words. You know, maybe you could do that, except the word of the root nagain is used in that verse in Sota. Like, there's so many different words. Sorry, Necha, not Sota. There's so many different words that we can deal with, such that normally, like, I mean, you've been to enough classes. Mm-hmm. One thing that I like doing is drawing grammatical or linguistic parallels. Meaning, take a word, see how it's used in different cases, and say, like, this is how you know these are grouped together, and you find the semantic range. Right? But so far we've seen, you know, the word, you know, nigun. Right, you know, bring me the minstrel. Right, in the Mishnah and Sota it uses shir, right, which is another word for song, and in the pasuk in Echa that's quoted in Sota, right, it's bachurim miniginatam. So it's almost like these terms are used synonymously. That to say, oh, the reason why it's okay in one place not the other is you want to split the hairs of the different types of music. Mm-hmm. I don't see how that's possible because it's almost like the words are used interchangeably, mm-hmm. right? But what that means is we have a lot of different opinions here. Mm-hmm. Some that say, right, so we've seen how music is essential. Mm-hmm. We've seen how music in general, and we've seen music is prohibited, mm-hmm. carte blanche. And then we've seen some indications that music is bad under certain conditions, mm-hmm. but otherwise could be okay. Mm-hmm. Right, and then, you know, there's also a difference perhaps between active and passive, mm-hmm. meaning is that the men, like men singing with women or women singing with men, is something that's active, mm-hmm. right? Playing an instrument is active. Mm-hmm. Rav is saying no, even listening, which is a passive passive, right? You, and not only passive, it's involuntary. You don't choose to hear. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, colloquially, you kind of choose. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean. Anyway, let's move on. Gemara in Sanhedrin 101a. Good, Mark.
Our rabbis taught, he who recites a verse of the Song of Songs and treats it as an air, and one who recites the verse of the banqueting table unseasonably, brings evil upon the world.
So there are two parts here. One is if you take Shir HaShirim, which, are you familiar with Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs? Shir HaShirim is it's a really difficult book to understand. It is, you know, in the plain sense of the word, it is effectively a romantic or erotic love song. The sages were, you know, very concerned about this. Art Scroll in their Chumash and in their Tanakh don't translate it, like, literally in the English side. They do it on the bottom, you know, the footnote things, or the annotations. They translate it using Rashi's explanation as a metaphor, right? But literally, it's an erotic love song. So, according to this Gemara, if you take Shir HaShirim and you turn it into a song, right? The brackets here from Sincino says secular. It says here, HaKorei Pasuk Shel Shir HaShirim Ve'ose Oto Kemin Zemer. Means if you're reading Shir HaShirim and you turn it into a type of a song, doesn't say secular otherwise, but you turn it into a song, right? Or at least, you know, other bass type of song, it is considered like you are, basically you're bringing evil to the world. Granted, it doesn't say prohibited asur, but it's not a good thing, right? And the other one is, well, you shouldn't recite verses out of their proper time. And then the Gemara continues about, like, what does it mean, proper time? You know, it continues. We'll discuss it. So, continue.
Let's see. Because
it brings evil upon the world. And now it explains.
Because the Torah girds itself in sackcloth and stands for...
No, that's not a question. Because the Torah girds itself in sackcloth.
And stands before the Holy One, blessed be, and laments before Him, sovereign of the earth, the children have made me as a harp upon which they frivolously play. He replies, my daughter, when they are eating and drinking, wherewith shall they occupy themselves? To which he rejoins, sovereign of the earth, if they possess scriptural knowledge, let them occupy themselves with the Torah, the prophets, and the writings. If they are students of the Mishnah with Mishnah, Halakhot, and Haggadot. If they are students of the Talmud, let them engage in the laws of Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles, and the respective festivals. By Simon B'Elazar, testified in the authority of Rabbi Shimon ben Hanina, he reads a verse in season, brings good to the world, as it is written, and a word spoken in season, how good is it?
Right. Now, there are a few fascinating things here. So what does it mean? Mm-hmm. Right. So here, like in the first, in the first verse in this section, the Gemara in Sota, we're saying that you could use songs incorrectly. Mm-hmm. Here, it's all, the indication is, you can use songs indirectly, even if they're, quote, from songs. Mm-hmm. If you sing books, verses from the Tanakh, mm-hmm. biblical verses, that's considered bad. If you're doing it to be, you're effectively what I would say, mechalel, right? Not by desecrating, I don't mean like, you know, you're burning it as much as you're taking something that is sacred verses, and you're turning it into pop music.
Doing that, so that's what I mean when they say unseasonably.
Well, kind of, right. So, I mean, if you look at the last one, yeah, the last line here I think is genius, because you find this all over the Gemara, where he says, Kol HaKorei Pasuk Bismano, whoever reads a pasuk in its proper time, Mevi Tova LaOlam, brings good to the world, Shene'emar, and what does he do? He quotes a pasuk. Meaning, the problem isn't quoting Pisukim. Chazal lived in Pisukim. Chazal knew Tanakh. They knew the Bible by heart. They quoted it, you know, all the time. It's like, oh, how's this? Because of this verse. This verse. You know, so if anyone says, like, you shouldn't learn Tanakh, Chazal knew of it. Slight digression. We have a cousin in Israel, and my sister once had a conversation with him, and he said, oh, yeah, it's this Pasuk, meaning it's this verse, in this Gemara. It's like, no, you have verses in Tanakh. The Gemara cites the Bible, but the Gemara itself is not, like, they're two separate entities. But the point of this Gemara is, like, and it says, like, well, what should they do instead of Pasuk? You should learn Torah, is the point. Meaning, occupy yourself. I mean, the argument is, well, if it's, what else should they be doing if not psukim? Says no. The problem isn't psukim. The problem is taking psukim that ought to be sacred and turning them secular. That's bad, right? If you and I are sitting together at a meal and we're arguing, you know, like we're doing Parshat HaShavua, right? People do that often. I don't know how often. Like, you know, people, we've got their whole bunch of learning programs,
right?
Or, you know, say, or learning Shalosh Shudas, people talk. Like, people eat and discuss Torah. Mm-hmm. You know, again, Shalosh Shudas, different Torah, thing like that. You're arguing over Torah. That seems to be fine because you're still treating it like Torah. The problem, it seems to be from this Gemara, is you're treating it like something secular. Shir HaShirim, because of the erotic nature of the book, is particularly prone to abuse. Mm-hmm. And even though, I mean, normally I just do straight Talmud, there's a passage from Rambam's interpretation to Mishnah that I think makes a very important distinction. Take source number 5.
In this context, it is worthy to note that songs, regardless of the language in which they are composed, are judged according to their content. We should follow the same guidelines with regard to them as mentioned above with regard to the 5 categories of speech.
The 5 categories of speech is the thing that he's talking about. Here he's making a distinction between language and content, which is important. Right? Because when people say secular music, say, oh, you know, English music is bad, but Hebrew music is good. Let him continue.
Although this point of clarification is obvious, it is necessary to mention it specifically because I have seen men of stature and pious individuals from our nation ignoring it. When they attend a party, a wedding, or a celebration of that like, and a person desires to sing a song in Arabic, they object and refuse to allow the song to be sung. This is true even when the song praises courage or forthrightness, i.e. it is in the category of desired speech, or it praises wine. If by contrast...
Like praising wine, right, he considers as good. So if anyone's paying attention, a whole bunch of Irish songs, just like, bam, like, those are okay. Yeah.
If by contrast a singer sings a Hebrew song, no one will object, nor will they remonstrate, even though the content of the song concerns subjects that are forbidden or should be eschewed.
Mm-hmm. You continue. Yeah. Okay.
This is utter foolishness. For the decision whether a particular subject is forbidden or permitted, desirable or objectionable, it is not dependent on the language in which it is spoken, but rather its content. If the content of a song is inspiring, it is necessary to sing it, regardless of the language in which it was written. And if the subject matter is corrupt, we are obligated to shun it, regardless of the language in which it is written.
Mm-hmm.
I feel, however, that there is a further point to be added in this regard. When there are 2 songs that both arouse sensual desire, extol it, and draw the soul in this direction, this is surely a shortcoming. And this is the category of speech that should be eschewed, for it arouses and stimulates a crude quality, as we explained in the 4th introductory chapter. When one of the songs was composed in Hebrew and the other in Arabic or Persian, hearing the Hebrew song and speaking of these matters in that language is less desirable according to the Torah. Because of the holiness of the language, it is not fitting to use it except for refined purposes. Surely the above applies if the person incorporates a verse from the Torah or the Song of Songs. This causes the song to move from the undesirable category to the forbidden. For the Torah has forbidden the use of the words of prophecy for songs about crude and lowly matters.
Right. So this is kind of how I explained before. He elaborates. He mentions specifically Song of Songs because that could be used for an erotic nature. But his point is, the problem with music isn't the music so much as the intentions behind it. If you're listening to music to get turned on, that seems to be the problem, regardless of the language or even regardless of the words. Right? If you have a like gorgeous soprano who's singing Shir HaShirim and you become aroused by it, according to Rambam, that's problematic. Right? It doesn't matter. Like, look at content. So anyone is a rock fan, Rush just got inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Anyone here listen to Rush?
Like, sorry, I know.
Canadian band, well, it's whatever. Well, phenomenal band. The drummer, not even going to whatever. The drummer was responsible for writing a lot of the lyrics because he was an really avid reader, especially on the tour bus, so he got incredibly poetic. And they've got some very deep songs there. Right? So, and not to mention just spectacular musicianship, especially from a three-man band. All right, we're not going to... All right, that's enough about Rush. The point is this. You know, you find some bands who sing in English who can sing some really meaningful and powerful stuff that aren't love songs. Bob Dylan, ring a bell, right? Yeah. Bob Dylan, especially for people of a certain generation, you know, Times They Are A-Changin', Blowin' in the Wind, really affected people's soul and their spirit, despite being written in English. And yet you can have, you've got love songs in Hebrew, right? So in love songs that use verses too, or using, you know, verses in a very, you know, romantic, you know, type of way. And the main problem is, according to Rambam, is using the Torah, or words of prophecy, is turning what ought to be sacred into something secular. And he mentions Shir HaShirim. One example I like giving of, you know, all or three major problems I usually have, or not usually have, that come up with Jewish music are the first three tracks of Dvekas 2. You probably know, Dvekas was a group, I'm trying to remember, if Kranzler was there, I think one of the Chaits was there. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on off the top of my head. Responsible for a lot of really gorgeous, gorgeous tunes that you're probably familiar with, even though you don't know it's from them. Like, anyone? Okay, well, I'm not the best singer, so not... yeah, you're not going to... When I started learning guitar, by the way, my roommate was a wonderful gauge, because if he could identify the song I was playing, it meant I was doing it well enough. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's on Dvekas 3. Here's the song list from, or at least the intro to Dvekas 2. The first one is Kol Dodi Hinezeva Medalek Al Haharim Mekapetz Al Hagevaot Hashmini Et Toliki Kol Echarik Umarech Naveh. It is, as for me, one of the most beautiful compositions and melodies that they've done, and, you know, maybe even beyond. Problem, the verse that they're singing is Shir HaShirim. Seems to go against the Gemara. No. Song number two, Od Yishama. The high, Jewish music, with few exceptions, has two parts. High part, low part, high part. And usually done in a way that's constantly repeating. Maybe if you get fancy, you'll throw in a bridge someplace. Like, you know, Kiva Moed has that little third section that throws people off when they try to do it for Lecha Dodi. So the low part is, Od Yishama B'Yare Yehuda U'hu V'chutzot Yerushalayim. The high part, Kol Sason V'kol Simcha Kol Chatan V'kol Kala Kol Sason V'kol Simcha Kol Chatan V'kol Kala, which is, what shall we do with a drunken sailor? Yeah. Don't know how many people picked that one up, but... And actually, one of the things is put him in the bridge with a captain's daughter. So I don't know how that works in with Od Yishama, whatever. The third one, annoys me personally, is L'kol Zeman V'Eit Tachat HaShemayim. Problem is, that's not the pasuk. The song is L'kol Zeman V'Eit. I have no idea what's going on upstairs.
Some sort of dance practice, maybe.
That could be. Wow. You know, we could ask them if they do Irish dancing, we can at least get a consistent beat, and that'll help. Anyway, it goes, L'kol Zeman V'Eit Tachat HaShemayim. My problem with that is that they are amending the verse to fit the song. The verse is, L'kol Zeman, stop. V'Eit L'kol Chefetz Tachat HaShemayim. So... The word, and have either one of you davened with a Karlebach Kabbalat Shabbat?
Long time ago.
Probably, yeah, me too.
All right, so when they do Mizmor LeDavid, butchers, absolutely butchers Tehillim, because you start and stop in middle of verses, destroys it completely. At least there you're saying the whole thing, you're just starting and stopping in the wrong places. L'kol Zeman V'Eit actually chops off words that are inconvenient. I can't say that's halachically usher, just bothers me. Huh. Anyway, so that's a place where, you know, this does get problematic because it's running late. I'll take the rest of the sources. Shulchan Aruch has a halacha about misuse of such songs, even in a prayer setting. This is how much kavanah, the intent, matters, at least according to Shulchan Aruch. Again, normally I just cite Gemaras, but I thought this is an important one that people really need to pay attention to. This is Shulchan Aruch Orach Chaim 53:11, discussing about who is fit to serve as a cantor, a shaliach tzibur. And he writes, a cantor who lengthens his prayer so that people should listen to his beautiful voice. If he does so because it is from the joy of his heart that he's giving praise to God with pleasantness, then he should receive a blessing. Tavo alav bracha. That's fine. And this is when he prays with a sense of honor and stands with fear and trembling. But if his intent is merely to hear his own voice and to enjoy in his own voice, this is disgraceful. And in any event, he whoever lengthens his prayer does not do good because of the trouble it causes the congregation. Even in a context of prayer, you're not supposed to schlep out your davening if it causes Torah HaTzibor, if you are causing a trouble to the congregation. Now here's also the difference your davening feels long versus is long. Just an example I'll give here is the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale. One of their chazans is Eli Kranzler, who I believe is also in Dveikus. Man has a gorgeous voice. When you hear him daven, you can tell when he sings, he is doing it from a place of Yirat Hashem or Ahavat Hashem. Certainly one of those two. But he's not doing it just to hear his voice. He puts his entire soul into it. I know there's no way that you can ever possibly quantify it, but trust me, it's there. Davening there also takes a really long time. However, can you call it a Torah HaTzibor? I would say no. Why? Because this is their minhag hamakom of what they do in the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale. One of the advantages that they have, and I've noticed that we have here in Stanton Street, is when you have other synagogues in the neighborhood, you can say, you're always welcome here, but this is what we do. If it's really a Torah HaTzibor, well, there are other minyanim you can daven in, but this is what we do here. Mm-hmm. And the only types of people who would go to that, what others might consider a long schleppy davening, are the people for whom it's not long and schleppy. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel long for them because they're involved, they get into it, like Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur davening. For some places, it is utterly painful. Mm-hmm. Why? Because you're entirely passive and you're just not feeling it. Other places, it can be just as long, but if you're into it with everyone else, there's no tircha. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's a community by community basis. What is a universal factor is who's ever being the chazan, singing is fine, as long as you're doing it from a good place. And this can come up sometimes when people do shtick davening. By shtick davening, I mean throw in, wacky tunes, or I should not say wacky, non-traditional tunes to make a certain point, right? So, one example, a friend of mine told me in Teaneck, one time in one minyan, so I have no idea which one, but I'll trust him that the story is true. What? Everyone knows, yes. Teaneck is in New Jersey. Someone got up and he sang, Hodu Lashem Ki Yitov Ki Leolam Chasto. So, if you don't know it, doesn't matter. If you do know it, you might feel Amazing Grace is inappropriate to use in a Jewish service. Right? Still, that's one issue. Right? Because what are you trying to do it other than to get a rise out of people? I confess I've actually done it myself, on a St. Patrick's Day. Worked in Whiskey in a Jar and Rare Old Mountain Dew, which happen to be like really nice songs, but whatever. That would be more of shtick. Mm-hmm. Sometimes tunes mean a great deal to someone, even if it's a secular song, mm-hmm. but it's something that evokes kavanah. Something that rabbis might even do is use tunes, chazan may use tunes that will complement the rabbi's sermon. Often, I don't know if it's universal, but seems often enough, the rabbi will give a sermon before Musaf, right? And if the rabbi touches on certain points, who's ever davening might do a tune that evokes one of those, right? Yom HaAtzma'ut, for example, right? That Shabbat, people understandably might talk about Israel, and I've heard V'shavu Vanim Ligvulam, right? The children shall return to their borders used. right? So that's sort of an integrated, that's where your thought is, right? Because assuming you paid attention to the drasha, so hearing those tunes can evoke what you were just thinking of before and may help focus, right? Again, the intent isn't, I know plenty of, not just chazanim, but Bali Tfilah. Chazanim are professionals, right? So they can actually think, well, you know, I studied to be a chazan, you hired a chazan. Like, if you're talking about a classically trained chazan, people know what they're getting, they know what to expect. But there are also people who daven for the Amud, like a regular Baal Tefillah, who puts up from the congregation, who just likes hearing their own voice. I heard one line, I honestly forget the context and who told this to me. It's a funny line. It says, your father made you an Avel, he didn't make you a chazan. You know, indicating, because normally people who's are saying Kaddish for someone, an important distinction there, where even in the context of prayer, it's problematic. And I'll conclude this section with a couple of verses from Yechezkel, from Ezekiel. This is 33 verses 30 to 22, just to hammer the point home that this is an old problem. Here's how it goes in English. As for you, son of man, your people are talking together about you by the walls and at the doors of the houses, saying to each other, come and hear the message that has come down from the Lord. My people come to you as they usually do, and sit before you and hear their words, but they do not put them into practice. Their mouths speak of love, but their hearts are greedy for unjust gain. Indeed, to them you are nothing more than one who sings love songs with a beautiful voice and plays an instrument well, for they hear your words but do not put them into practice. The old nivuah was almost a performance piece. The problem here is people said, hey, let's go see what the prophet is doing today. If all these things are is for entertainment and don't actually affect you, I'm not going to say anything about what is asur, what is forbidden. But this is an old problem. Even Jewish songs, like people might, you know, sing like, you know, let's try to pick a good one. Even Haven Yakirli Ephraim, nice tune, fine. What does it mean? Just sing it because it's a nice tune, nice melody? What does it mean? There are ways of, in a sense, secularizing the verses of Tanakh, even if you might be doing it for a spiritual sense. Because this isn't just for enjoyment. The words, let's take it a step back. If you're going to assume that the words of Tanakh, the words of the Bible, are from God and are therefore sacred, then they're supposed to mean something. Beyond the tune, beyond what you take it to mean after because of the tune, they're supposed to matter for what they are, because they are words from God. My father's teacher, Chacham Yosef Ur, said, we already have a tune for the psukim, and they were given to us, by the Masoretes. Those are those trump marks, those diacritics that tell you the tunes. That is the traditional tune for these verses. Right? It's not like taking them into pop music. But Yechezkel even shows you the risk of ignoring the words and the message. Part of me, if I had any like creative musical talent, would turn that into a song on its own just for the irony. But that's what things are. Here's one of my great example for this, of people just not caring about what they're singing. There's a song, I'm even forgetting, I'm sorry, just been too busy planking on it. There's one of the songs in, the Jewish Welt, is singing the Misha Berach for Misha Berach, the prayer for the ill. One of the lines, or at least in the version that he sings, which is from Shabbat, Shabbos Kodesh Hi Milizoik, or at least that's the way he sings it, which literally means Shabbat is preventing me from crying out. The reason why that's there is normally we don't make requests of God for Shabbat. So in a way, like, we're sort of remembering, like, yes, we're praying for someone to get better, but throwing in, we're not going to go too much because it's Shabbat. But in context, it's like, yeah, we really shouldn't be singing this song. The words don't matter anymore. I understand. The Misha Berach is not in the same status or stature as a verse that comes from God. But it shows the problem that even in the firm world we have with music, that, it's, if you want to break it up into stages, there's, singing for, licentious purposes. That's bad. Doesn't matter what language or how. Then there, and you know, that's on one extreme. The other extreme is using music for spiritual purpose, where you're actually using even, let's say, tunes correctly to get you in a state when you worship God. There's something else, though, about using the verses from Torah, and which is using them in an incorrect fashion. What could be using the verses from God as an incorrect fashion? One of them, which is a little more obvious, secularizing them as turning them into regular songs like anything else you'd sing. But it could also be even taking it out of their meaning such that you no longer appreciate the words that you're singing, right? Even if it might be for a spiritual component, right? These are messages that God is trying to tell you. That's a lot more important than whatever tune is imposed on them, no matter how beautiful it might be. All right, so we still have time a bit, so I'll do the last section. This is really super duper duper controversial. And this is going to be just a very quick overview. And yes, I understand cherry-picked sources and all that. There's a full class we can do on this and not cover everything. So we'll cover a bit on just a little bit about Kol Isha, right? Hearing a woman sing. First example that I know of where this happened is Exodus, after the Song of the Sea. This is chapter 15, 20, and 21. It says, then Miriam, the prophet, Aaron's sister, took a trimble in her hand, and all the women followed her with trimbles and dancing. Miriam sang to them, sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. Both the horse and driver he has hurled into the sea. Now, you'll notice that I underlined and bolded them, which doesn't mean much in English. In the Hebrew, it means everything. It's Vatan Lahem Miriam. Why is that important? In the previous verse, it says, Vateitzena kol hanashim acharei betupim cholot. The women followed Miriam. People will explain, what does this mean? The women and the men sang, but sang separately. This pasuk shows that's not true. Because if the women were singing independently, it would be Vata'an lahen with a nun in the feminine. The fact that it's Vata'an Lahem Miriam means there must have been, grammatically at least, men included or incorporated in the singing. We also have another example of joint men and women singing from the very beginning, from the book of Judges, Sefer Shofetim, chapter 5, verse 1, Vatashar Devoro Varak Ben Avinom Bayomahu Lemor. After the victory over Sisera, Dvorah and Barak sang together, and again, based on grammar, it would seem, it's interesting that, you know, even though they're sort of singing it together, Dvorah seems to get top bill. Let me think about this for a second. Well, she is mentioned first, and the grammar of the verse seems to give her precedence. So it seems, based on this, Dvorah was singing lead, and Barak was singing backup. Right? So here's biblical example of, at the very least, mixed singing. If not, woman singing. What's the problem? It usually gets brought down to, the debate can be reduced to a Gemara in Brachot 24a. The discussion is regarding Kriyat Shema. We'll see. Here's how it goes. Rav Isaac said a handbreadth exposed married woman. Well, forget married woman because the brackets are from Sincino, but married is not in the text. So a handbreadth exposed in a woman, tefach be'isha erva. Any handbreadth exposed is considered erva, which is, uses here, constitutes sexual incitement. We'll run with that. That's actually a decent translation. In what way? Meaning, how so? Shall I say if one gazes at it? But has not Rav Shesha had already said? Why did Scripture enumerate the ornaments worn outside the clothes with those worn inside? To tell you that if one gazes at the little finger of the woman, it is as if he gazed at her secret place. Meaning, there are people like this. You know, look, we live in New York. Plenty of people like this around. If a man gawks at a woman, stares, ogles, whatever definition, it's not just I look at a woman, but if I am staring and staring intently, if anything, there's a difference between ro'eh, someone who sees, and mistakel, which is you are really, peering or leering, to use, a more accurate term, because peering in this context is something else. That's a problem in general. And it says, no, this means in one's own wife when he recites the Shema. To explain what the context is, we have an obligation to recite the Shema twice a day. Once in the morning, once at night. But Shach Bechav Kumecha. Now, when you recite Kriyat Shema at night, we call it Kriyat Shema Al Hamita. Kriyat Shema that you say in bed. Now, I've been, you know, man and his wife, husband and wife, lie down together in bed. I know that happens. Scandalous. Right? So he wants to say the Shema. How much should his wife have to be dressed in order for him to be able to say the Shema? Or to put it another way, in order for him to be able to concentrate to say the Shema, right, what can he not look at on his wife? That might be a better way of putting it. So according to one opinion, it's tefach, any amount. Rav Chisda says, a woman's leg is a sexual incitement. As it says, uncover the leg, pass through the rivers. And it says, afterwards, thy nakedness shall be uncovered. Ye that shame shall be seen. Here's where we get, here's our money quote for our purposes. Samuel said, a woman's voice is sexual incitement. Kol b'isha irva. As it says, for sweet is thy voice and thy countenance is comely. My father likes pointing out that the full verse is, Hashmi ini et kolech, let me hear your voice. Ki kolech arivu marech navet, which would seem to indicate permissiveness. So Rishishit says, hair is a problem, doesn't say married or not, and it compares a woman's hair to a flock of goats. I don't know how, whatever. Point is, according to this Gemara, there are two components that come up, and we'll see how they were both expressed in later halachic authorities. Listening to a woman's voice to get turned on would be a problematic, like hamistakel. The other problem would be specifically during Kriyat Shema, which is the context here, because it's defined as erva. But what is the isur? What is the prohibition of erva? Now, to say that, well, all forms of erva are prohibited, well, that is simply false. How do I know? If a man could never look at women in stages of undress, then you would never be able to have a male physician ever have a female patient. Right? Clearly, at some point, erva is going to be involved. You assume, though, and unfortunately, this is not a... You know, unfortunately, this assumption has been dashed every now and again. You assume that there's no sexual connotation there. You assume that there's no interaction there, in which case, it's, you know, there may be nakedness, but it's not erva, right? And that is a very important distinction. So here's how Rambam, you know, writes, summarizes this halacha in Isurei Bia 21:2. And the one who gazes even at a woman's pinky finger with the intent to be sexually gratified, as if he looked at her secret place, and even if only to listen to the voice of a woman to whom he is prohibited, or to look upon her hair, this is forbidden. That's how Rambam summarizes this, based on the first half of what I quoted from that Gemara in Brachot. Now, what this means, by the way, isn't that the prohibition is for a woman to sing as much as for a man to get turned on by listening to a woman sing. If you, according to Rambam, and I will stipulate here that this, like many other things, people disagree with Rambam, but let's just assume Rambam for a moment. We'll do Shulchan Aruch, and I'll wrap up in, you know, why those are important here. According to Rambam, if I really want to say that women aren't allowed to sing because I'm not allowed to get turned on, then I would have to force you to wear gloves and basically wear a burqa. Cover your gloves and cover your hair completely. Why? Lest I get turned on. But we don't say that. In fact, later sources focus on an idiom called darkan lechasot, what is normally covered. Because there's going to be a degree of social relativity and desensitization, because context matters. If in your society, women are normally dressed in a certain way, meaning something is normally covered, once it becomes uncovered, then it does become scandalous and arousing. As opposed to if something is normally, if it's normally uncovered, you're going to be desensitized. Rav Temler once gave the issue of a woman going out in a slip, right? Now, we live in New York, it's summertime. Women, you know, certainly, let's say from the waist down, cover a lot less than what would be covered with a slip. right? But if one would just go out in a stam slip, that would be a sense of a woman going out with a sense of undress. There's a completely different context behind it, far beyond, you know, what might be covered. I don't want to go through this completely. I highly recommend everyone go back to the class I gave on tzniut and what modesty means. I'm only mentioning this for the specific point of certain things might be considered more arousing than others. But the problem isn't with the women. The problem is with the men getting arousal from it. Because, again, if you don't force women to wear gloves because a man might be mistakel on her pinky, according to Rambam, logic might or would probably still apply for a woman singing. Shulchan Aruch HaNor HaChaim 75.3 says, one ought to be careful from hearing a woman singing at the time he recites Shema. Right? There you go. The problem here, at least, seems to be limited to just Kriyat Shema, or specifically. In Raman, this applies even for his own wife. But a voice which is heard regularly is not considered licentious. Right? If you're not going to get turned on by it, you don't have Irva. And that's the Ram, the Rama, the Ashkenazi Raman. I'm mentioning this here because people say, oh, it's Sephardi stuff. Ashkenazi Raman here says, Aval kol haragil bo eina erva. The wife is different because one would hope a man has sexual feelings towards his spouse. All right? But otherwise, kol haragil bo eino erva. That is the Ashkenazi Rama, Aruch HaYom 75.3. Now, even though there's a lot more written on here, it seems to me to be the most rational reads of the Gemara. Where, again, you saw the Gemara off of this is based. There's a problem with deriving improper sexual benefit from women, which again, is a problem on the man, not the woman. And there's a second problem, generic, whether or not you get turned on by it, specifically by Kriyat Shema, although it seems the Rama might even be lenient. Right? That's the issue with Kol Isha. That simple. An example of women singing and it not being a problem is a Mishnah in Moed Katan, 3:8. Women may raise a wail during the festival week, but may not clap their hands in grief. Rav Ismail says, there are those that are close to the beer clap their hands in grief. On days of the new moon and Hanukkah, and of Purim, they may raise a wail and clap their hands in grief. Neither on the former nor the latter occasions do they chant a dirge. To explain what this means, back in the day, people used to hire women to wail at funerals and would, in effect, I mean, I don't know if they actually sang Don't Fear the Reaper, but they certainly did something kind of musical. In mitapachot, as you're banging on drums, there was something musical about their funeral procession. It also might not have been as elaborate as a New Orleans funeral. If anyone wants, you can look that up on YouTube or see the really super campy James Bond movie Live and Let Die as a plot point. I remember that?
Yeah.
Thank you. Sorry. I get relieved when people get my references. Statistically, someone has to at some point.
Well, I haven't gotten most of them, so it's good. Not
yeah. Well, anyway, the point is this. Women sang at these things and no one had a problem. Mm-hmm. Right? The last source here is an article recently written, the most recent as of this recording, edition of Tradition, volume 46, 1, published 2013. This is from page 22. This is written by Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, who had come out, he is the son of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, if anyone's familiar. The article is called Kol Isha, A Woman's Voice. And he had said something previously regarding soldiers listening to women soldiers in the army. And he wrote a piece, he wrote a passage here that's very much in line with his tradition. Like, it sounds very much like someone from his Misorah, being someone who said in the tradition of Rav Yosef Beer's Soloveitchik. And he writes this. The problem created in the wake of such sexual thoughts raised by Kol Isha is not just the thought itself or in the physiological results, the notion that, quote, one should not think sexual thoughts during the day lest he come to impurity at night, quoting a Gemara to Boat 46a, but also that the thought establishes the relationship between man and woman as biological male-female system rather than a spiritual bond between man and woman. By way of homily, we may say that, quote, the thoughts of sin are more difficult than sin. This is a Gemara in Yoma. Since, while sin is a flawed act in its own right, the thoughts of sin reflect upon the existence of man as a being of nature. The halachic significance of this is the extension of the prohibition of kol isha on the basis of concern for sexual thoughts to a context where it is not justified to do so. It is not just unhelpful, it is harmful. It brings about an emphasis on natural existence and paints the human condition as one of sexual existence alone. Indeed, this kind of extension of prohibition provides a wider halachic safety net regarding the thoughts themselves, but at the same time it amplifies the classification of human existence as biological natural at the expense of the perception of man as a more elevated being. The posek who is concerned for sexual thoughts in a case of women's song where the listener does not intend to derive sexual pleasure perceives man as a creature whose natural urges overbear him. Therefore, stringent psak in this manner diminishes man's character and minimizes the image of the divine within him. Now, I've said this, like ideas like this, similarly for years. I could not, in my wildest dreams, ever hope to be as eloquent as Rav Moshe Lichtenstein was here. The way that I phrase it is this, and here's a story that I had in rabbinical school. In Grus, this is why I use Kollel in Israel and Beit Vegan. So we were all basically staying in dorms and small apartments, living really close. I won't say on top of each other because in context it's bad, but really close. One day after our Yira Deish year, the Rosh Kollel of David Miller keeps us for a bit. And he was giving very gentle mussar. If you know Rav David Miller from Gris, he's a really gentle man. Gave very gentle mussar that he thought that couples were over-fraternizing with each other. Right? Just too much inter-couple socialization. You come kedoshim to you and be separate. And I remembered at the time being incredibly annoyed. Again, I cannot articulate it nearly as well as Rav Moshe. I mean, he captured what I was feeling at the time. Because you're basically implying I can't have a conversation with a married woman without thinking in the back of my head she's a sexual object. It's even worse that given that this is why you smicha kolel in Israel, you're talking to future rabbis. How can I function as a future rabbi and not talk to married women? Or to put it another way, if I'm a rabbi and I'm talking to married women, and this in theory would also apply to single women too, and I think of them as sexual objects, don't we have a bigger problem in the rabbinate? You would hope that rabbis ought to be able to do that. Or to put it another way, I call it the pink elephant problem. You know the pink elephant? Don't think of a pink elephant. What's the first thing you think of? Mm-hmm. Pink elephant. Mm-hmm. Same thing applies to tziniyut. The more that I say this is prohibited because of tziniyut, this is prohibited of tziniyut, the more you take innocuous interactions and sexualize them. Men and women can't socialize at a kiddush because of tziniyut. Implication, men and women having kiddush together is somehow sexual. Men and women need separate entrances to get into synagogue. Implication, same entrance, there's something sexual there. All of that is problematic, and so in a sense, I would take it a step further than Rav Moshe Lichtenstein. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein is saying you're describing it as such. I would even say that by doing so, you are encouraging it, and you are sort of putting it in their heads that it's always going to be sexual. Meaning, Rav Moshe is being descriptive about how people are, how people are right now. That you're implying that basically, men. And I guess, women too, like, we just can't control ourselves, right? We have no self-control. There's no spiritual element to us. We can't possibly help but get sexually aroused by listening to women. He says, that's what you're implying. And I'd say, take it as like, no, when you take the expansive view on erva, like, if that's your control with men getting turned on to everything, then effectively you're even putting more ideas in their head that they may not have even had before, just by pure implication. Right? So that is, how long? Hey, that didn't take so long. Kol Isha in a nutshell, it's something which probably will get a lot of flack for, but, we can talk about that privately. But given that it is, when I get questions of music, Kol Isha comes up often. I can say that, a friend of mine, not going to mention, well, actually I shouldn't, I won't use either one of them because I'm not sure if either one of them got out, but let me just say this. A friend of mine caught a prominent figure from Yeshiva University at the opera. And, was kind of ribbing him about that. Mm-hmm. I've seen Broadway musicals, gone with my parents to Broadway musicals. My father has no issue with it, largely because of, these things too. And yes, I was not aroused by it at all. I was actually more annoyed at Phantom of the Opera, but that was not because of the singers, because I was like, wait, there are only two songs in this entire play, but, you know, yes, something else. All right. Any questions, thoughts, comments?
Maybe the advocates of a more hardline position, maybe that's the goal, is to create a more sector to play sort of devil's advocate. The goal is to create a more
sexualized culture,
because that way you're encouraging your men to marry when they're 20 and, you know, keep birth
rates going. What you do is, see, here's the issue. You over-sexualize the culture, but you minimize any intergender interaction. Mm-hmm. And then you wonder, gee, why is there so much molestation going on? Mm-hmm. Right? So you're going to over-sexualize yet repress. Mm-hmm. Doesn't seem to make sense. And there are, by the way, in terms of sexuality, particularly the heterosexual, there are a lot of people doing a lot of work on that. Mm-hmm. And you have some very good work, some very important work that gets a little bit beyond the scope. Well, I shouldn't say beyond... How to put it? It is a fascinating question. You know what? Might even be worth its own class in its own right. Maybe even several classes about current Jewish questions and sexuality. I would take a long time to. I have no idea off the top of my head how to do that. It is a good question. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they're getting into. I doubt that that's what the motivation is. Even if it is that motivation, that's my source sheets for my Shavuot Shira right over there.
Obviously.
The Judaism of good intentions. You got to worry about the consequences.
Yes.
And if it's breaking, and if it's causing more problems, and the truth is there's almost no way to quantify, is it causing more problems? But there are a lot more problems than anyone is going to admit. Mm-hmm. And I know this based on the limited number of complaints I get, kal vachomer people from within certain communities get.
Right. Yeah. And I'm not saying I'd want to live in one of those communities,
well,
but I'm just saying... This might be kind of
the very fact that you come to my class would indicate.
Yeah, exactly. Right,
puts you in a certain camp.
Yes.
Any thoughts, comments, questions?
Oh.
All right. Not a problem. We'll pass for now.
Pass for now.
Okay.
But yeah, I could say a lot.
All right. I'll have a wonderful week.